You're welcome. And it's also nice to kind of introduce the activity, telling people what they're going to be doing. We've had people opt out, and they should always be given the option to opt out because it is a pretty intense activity.
Okay, Peter, one more.
Oh. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Bridget. These presentations actually really do tie together quite well. Our Washington FACE program puts out the fatality reports, and they've been translating theirs into Spanish and sort of pushing them out through us with this population that I'm going to talk about as well. So, okay. I guess I'll try to keep my own time. If I'm rambling, tell me. Yeah. My name is Steve Hecker. I'm going to be presenting a project that's kind of the middle portion of a project that's ongoing that we've been working on with day laborers in Seattle over the last 3 years. And I want to acknowledge Hillary Blecker, who was the lead person on this. Unfortunately, she moved back to Philadelphia, so we don't have her around anymore, but she's largely responsible. Noah Satius, who's the principal investigator on this, and the others here, Janice Camp, Sarah Lowry, and Butch DeCastro, who are all involved in this. So the specific project aims of this set, well, let me back up a little bit. We've been working with two day labor centers in the Seattle area. One is primarily a Latino clientele called Casa Latina. The other is a very unusual place that's called the Millionaire Club. And it is, by reputation, the oldest day labor program in the United States. And it serves largely a white and African American clientele. So two very different places. The particular project I'm going to talk about was our effort to design a weekly one-hour safety training delivered in English at Millionaire Club and Spanish at Casa Latina. And these were kind of the objectives of it, to integrate safety hazards that we've identified with this population, to do it in a participatory way. And one of our aims was to try to, in each session, incorporate some of the legal rights, hazard recognition, and appropriate PPE into all the trainings. And then we had an effort at evaluating this, which, while not fully successful, is a step along the way. Had some interesting conversations with people here at APHA working with similar groups of workers on the challenges of evaluation in this group. So what is day labor? I'll go over this fairly quickly. Jobs found at, in our case, worker centers or outside home improvement stores, often lacking a clearly defined employer. We have come to call our project the project on precarious work, and day labor is one piece of precarious work. And as Garrett Brown mentioned yesterday, working in California and working overseas in Asia and Latin America, he's found over the years that things are getting more and more similar rather than more and more different. And I think this is one of the aspects of that we have this workforce population as a result of deindustrialization and immigration that is related to globalization, and we've got a workforce that is very precarious, very contingent, and doesn't have access to many services that fixed employment provides. So about 3 years ago, Noah Satius and others launched a study, a survey study of day labor, and they interviewed 180 day laborers. They were surveyed at the two worker center sites and at a Home Depot. And what they found, I'm going to go through this really quickly, it's been published in American Journal of Industrial Medicine. Noah Satius is a lead author. Nearly half of the jobs that people did were in construction. They found 45 people reported injuries. We calculated this as a rate of about 30 per 100 FTE, or as Noah likes to say, plus or minus 100%. You know, it's pretty rough, but this would be five times the BLS rate. And this graph shows some of the self-identified hazards, and you can see lifting was the highest, eye injuries, dust, chemicals, and then this one, whoops, I'm sorry, well, we'll forget about that. The working at heights, even though it wasn't the highest bar there, was something that was really expressed frequently as a fear. So coming out of the survey data and work with the labor centers, three pilot training sessions were developed. And these were offered at a community college training center site. We transported the day laborers from their site to this location and provided incentives like there was a cash incentive, there was lunch, and they got a certificate for going through this training. And the focus of these trainings were the two most hazardous things identified, which was lifting strains and sprains and working at heights. A lot of the focus was on working at heights. And these were actually quite successful in, I think each of the four had at least 12 to 15 people in it. They were conducted in Spanish for the one center and English for the other. And, but we, the limitation was that getting people off site was challenging with this group. And so we came back to talk to the centers about what it would take to reach a larger number of these laborers. And so we planned something that was closer to the worker center locations, that was accessible to people during the workday. And we dealt with this issue of what is the proper approach for training a transient population like this. So what we came up with in concert with the labor centers was to offer a series of one-hour sessions. They were offered Monday morning at 7 a.m. At one center and another day of the week at the others. And they would take place while workers were waiting to be called for jobs as a way of, you know, if someone had the choice between training and going out and getting paid that day, they were going out. And so this reduced the need to make that choice. It brought with it some other challenges, like complete chaos surrounding you while you're doing the training. But anyone present there was eligible to participate. And as far as incentives, one of the centers offered bus tickets, and we offered cards and certificates for anybody who completed five of the 10-week cycle. Training needed to be participatory and visual in style. There was a wide range of literacy in both centers, more so in among the Spanish speakers. And the a second piece, which I mentioned before, is because we never really knew who was going to come back from week to week, it was important to integrate the major themes into each session, no matter what the hazard topic of that session was. So we tried to get some of the worker rights, how to recognize hazards, and PPE issues integrated into each topic session. And the PPE, you know, this is a population and a type of work where you know, you can talk about the hierarchy of controls all you want, but what you're probably going to get in these people's hands are a couple of pieces of PPE if you're lucky. And we didn't neglect the need for other kinds of controls, but this became an important piece of what we talked about. So based on the survey, based on further discussions with staff at the centers and with workers themselves, this was the cycle one topics that were come up with. And you could see working at heights, noise, lifting, repetitive motion. And so we did have separate sessions on things like workers' rights and workers' comp, but they were also somewhat integrated into these others. We left an open week to allow for things that came up during other sessions to be covered in this week. So we went through this 10-week cycle, and during that, during those focus group type weeks, we kind of gathered further information about what more they might want. And what came out of this was that a number of, there became a recurrent theme about chemical and dust exposures, and people thought they might have been exposed to asbestos, but weren't sure. So we designed the second cycle around some of these things, and they were about both the hazards themselves, but also about the kind of jobs. So for instance, there was a focus in this cycle about insulating, people doing insulation work, people doing painting work, and demolition. Those were three types of jobs that had some of these exposures that were recognized. So let me talk about evaluation, and then I'll tell you what happened with the trainings themselves. The evaluation methods, we started out with sort of a more classic set of questions about, you know, attitudes towards safety. And we realized pretty quickly after a couple of applications of this evaluation type that we really needed to figure out a way to find out from people, what did you actually do? Because asking questions, first of all, is particularly for the Latino population, I think this is, you know, I think there's a cultural component of this, and there's also, you know, a very underserved component of this. It's like everything we did for them was just great, you know, and so they wanted to tell us what we wanted to hear, that, oh, yeah, did you go out to your work site and look for hazards before you went to work? Oh, yeah, sure. We always did that. And so we were trying to get a way, and I've had some discussions with people here about this problem, how you actually get at realistic answers without actually doing observations. But so our evaluation form kind of changed over time, but for most of these period of both cycles, we used the final form. And we conducted the evaluation about once a month during the winter and spring of 2008, and it was done orally because of the literacy issues. And so Hillary would actually sort of have the list and read things out, and then people had a ballot so they could mark their answers without necessarily having to be able to read what the question was. We had, you know, this is sort of trying to do science in a very uncontrolled situation. We tried to use the number of trainings that people went to as a predictor of expected behavior change. We couldn't do a pre and post kind of thing. So that was our metric. You know, if you went to five sessions, hopefully you did more, you improved your safety more. Well, you can probably guess what the result of that was, but I'll tell you. So the results of the training. As of May 2008, we had done 55 of these, pretty much divided between the two centers. There had been 500 participants cycled through, not necessarily individual participants, but a total of 500 persons attending sessions. We did the periodic focus groups to gain feedback during those sessions and adjusted the further ones. And we did a fair amount of hands-on exercises to allow participation and some evaluation of what learning took place. I don't have electronic pictures, but I actually have a copy of the curriculum. And what Hillary did was use a lot of large format photographs to get as tools, many to do with working at heights, getting people to say, okay, what's wrong with this picture? The evaluation, we didn't find a correlation between the number of trainings attended and safe behavior. It could have been for a lot of reasons. The behavior questions may have been too specific to depend on the training concepts getting across. There were multiple factors influencing actions, including what kind of jobs they went out on, et cetera. The number of trainings was not a good surrogate. Some people could have gone to one training, got the message, and gone out and done something much more of an improvement than somebody who sat through five but didn't have the same motivation or understanding. And we also found that it was difficult to inject our major themes of PPE, hazard recognition, and worker rights into each one of these hours. There was a lot to cover, so the idea was good, but it was hard to do that. So, one of the things we should probably do is do some comparisons of doing sessions just on those topics and looking for changes compared to the integration. This is part of an ongoing project. What we're doing now, next month we're doing our first Spanish language OSHA 10-hour course with the Casa Latina group to try to develop some capacity, a bit more extensive high-level training for certain of their members. They're a very good organization in terms of trying to build their membership and build capacity within their membership to improve and have some of their own resources. And so we'll continue to do that. We've got a couple of proposals out to do other projects. One of the things from this group that we always get on evaluations is that the safety is fine, but we really want skills training, and we really want to learn how to use more tools and equipment. And so one of our proposals is to try to integrate safety training with more skills training. And we haven't had those funded yet, but that's one of the efforts. One of the other issues is the language issue, and we're very interested in trying to integrate some of the safety and ESL training. My wife is an ESL instructor, and there's a lot of interest in vocation-specific content for ESL. So these are all great ideas we have. We just need money and time. So that's my presentation. That's an example of one of the kinds of pictures that would be used in the training. What's wrong with this picture? Thank you, and be happy to respond to questions, and then we can open it up to discussion. Thanks. Yes.
I would commend you for trying to reach this workforce. It's very difficult. Some of the things that I found is that the workers may know that what they're being asked to do is wrong, but they lack the assertiveness to speak up about it. Did you do any of that soft skills training?
Well, we certainly talk about that issue a lot because it comes up, and it's a real dilemma with this population. You know, the Department of Labor and Industries always wants to come and reach this audience, right? And our question to them is always, well, what do you really have to offer this audience in terms of, yeah, it's good to know about rights, but it's got to be reality-based. It can't be that, you know, this is what exists on paper. And so we've talked in these sessions very realistically, and in fact, some of what we come down to sometimes is the best thing that a day laborer can learn is to refuse a job, to turn a job down, because there's no way that they're going to get what they need to do that job safely. And so we do talk about things like that. And I think in some of the discussions that I've seen, I mean, I'm, as a not very good Spanish comprehender listening to these discussions go on, I think that that does go on in groups, people talking about how to negotiate. One of the things they found, for instance, in the Home Depot, the non-labor center, worker center areas, is that there were informal groups in which people would kind of try to protect somebody who was being picked to go out on a job by finding out what exactly are you going to have him do and stuff like that. So I think there's some informal stuff. I think it is important. It's just hard to figure out exactly what tack to take. Yes? They're both actually worker centers. The Hispanic one is, I would characterize it more as a movement kind of organization. The Millionaire Club is more of a charitable kind of organization.
My question is there any attempt by the worker center in a more formal way to try to weed out the jobs that are obviously
Very good question, because one of the desires of our PI, Noah Satius, has been to augment our activities by providing services to potential employers. The centers are very iffy about this. In principle, they think it's a good idea. In reality, they're afraid of driving away business. And so we haven't gotten over that. And I talked to somebody from Chicago yesterday who said they've had the same experience. So I think with homeowners who hire people, it's pretty easy to do that, because homeowners generally just don't know what the hell they're asking people to do, as opposed to contractors who might hire people because they don't want to be in the above ground market. But it's a good question. It's a good direction to go. We've had trouble getting it going. Don?
Yeah, that's Steve. I'm just wondering if you had any pushback from the trainees in this whole issue of what we call sometimes rights versus reality. And what I mean is, when you're teaching about worker rights and also about PPE, it's, let's say, fall protection and tie-off, and residential, which is probably where most of the working, I suspect probably zero have had fall protection. And when you teach rights and PPE, we teach harnesses and lanyards and what OSHA says. And so we have to be careful about our credibility as instructors if we're telling them something that doesn't connect with the reality. So I just wondered if, if there was a chasm there, if you were able to cross it somehow.
We're constantly working in that chasm area on those very issues. I mean, fall protection is a great example. We had debates within our own group, and I was on the side that said, you know, you can't really talk much about harnesses with this group of people, because, as you know, even in a legitimate construction project with legitimate contractors and unions, it's a very complicated issue to choose the right harness, to know what your fall distance is going to be and all that. And so to hand somebody a harness as if that's going to protect them when you don't know if there's tie-off points or anything else is ethically challenging. We have, I think, done a pretty good job of being reality-based. And when I was referring to maybe the best thing you can tell them is not take the job, that's exactly what I was thinking of, because you're not going to get that protection working 20 feet up in the air in most of these jobs, and the best thing they could do is probably not do it. So with other things, it's a little more, it's a little blurrier. But as with any class, you do get people who say, you know, that's never going to happen where I work, and we're certainly cognizant of that. And so it's kind of a gingerly thing of trying to push the envelope a little bit to get better, to try to get people to ask for protection, things like that. I don't want to dominate the rest of this, so I want to throw it open to questions to any of us, if there are. Yes?
Yes, I'm Janet Bellatine from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I've been working in the area of safety of young
Not in this. We have a separate young worker project, but not in these groups because they're mostly prohibited activities for people under 18. So, well, they do them, but not through these worker centers because they have. I'm sure there are people at Home Depot who are under 18, but we don't have any way of getting them to our trainings. So. Not in these particular sessions.
The second question I have is for the safe report. Is there a way to get these reports by age? Like, you know, I know you can get them by industry.
Yeah. But on the NIOSH website, they have a section that's just youth reports, and those fatalities involve people as young as 9. I saw a lot of farm workers accidents. So within the youth category, paper boys getting struck by cars, a pizza shop guy getting brought into a dough hook, you know, you can.
Yeah, we'd be giving them like 4 hours for that.
Yeah, and the youngest group that we've really trained have been this group of high school students. They're seniors, so they're probably in the 17, 18-year-old range. And it's through an OSHA 10 construction industry awareness class.
Jessica?
So, two things. One, just kind of to the question of day labor organizations. I know that the National Day Labor Association has some information, and I believe out in Long Island, New York, there was some organizing going on with day labor basically setting labor standards for themselves and collectively saying, this is our minimum wage, this is these are the work conditions that we're willing to work under. And so when employers went to those centers or even to informal quarters, there were some standards. So just to that question that was out in the audience. And then to Steve, for the trainers, who were the trainers in these? Were they day laborers or were, because at Lowe's we trained day laborers to offer training to their coworkers, especially under stress in the summer. So who were the trainers
in this were primarily Hillary and Sarah Lowry, who are both working for the university and are both bilingual. And we brought in other people for individual topics, sometimes in translation if it was some, you know, more detailed chemical kind of thing. The OSHA 10 that I described at the end is kind of our first effort to try to build capacity to for these folks to be able to do training themselves. One of the instructors for the OSHA 10 is a carpenter who's come through our OSHA Ed Center and become authorized as an OSHA trainer. He's Mexican and bilingual, and so he's going to be doing a lot of training. He's a union carpenter, far from a day laborer, but culturally I think he will be very good for these folks. So that's the plan. That's the long range plan. See that?
I'm curious about the photo boy. Do you think that for it to work effectively, it has to be out in the open, picture taking with permission? Or I'm just imagining if there's a process, which maybe isn't as great, but just doing a lot of the open river workers where they are taking cell phone pictures off the side,
right.
But then does that not fit the method?
I think it's something that we're not in a position to advocate. But when we did, when we showed this to the AFSCME trainers, that was exactly what came up. They were going, we can take pictures. It certainly does the same thing. They were talking about, in that particular case, nursing homes where they would be taking pictures and then using those pictures to present to legislators. So. I think at some point the pictures have to be used in some way where other people are going to see them. And that can be certainly off-site. I think that you know, there are a lot of ways that type of method can be used. It doesn't have to be, you know, strictly done the way we did it. We were just, I think we were fortunate because we could just, you know, do these presentations to 100 custodians at a time.
I have a little story related to that that I heard just last week from a machinist's business agent that they represent a large lumber company which has, you know, major safety program at the corporate level, but there's often a disconnect between that and their middle management in the mills. And he was saying that he has his workers or stewards on the floor when something comes up that's clearly against policy, take their cell phone camera out, shoot it, and send it to him, and he's got it to the corporate safety people in no time at all, and there is no argument from the supervisor or foreman. He said, actually, there was a supervisor who was fired as a result of one of these incidents. And so, yeah, I guess they're going to start taking the cell phones away from the work.
One technique of training is to do what they call hazard mapping. Remember, at the beginning of the training, people can get together and they identify particular places at the work site where there are hazards. And this is much more visual, elaborate thing. And that it seems to me to be adapted as well to a more formal training where you first go out and you take all these photos and then you use this.
No, it absolutely could be used in that way. And, you know, people often say, well, isn't this just visual hazard mapping? And it can be used that way. And it can also be used, you know, to try to promote policy change as well. But I do think it can be a valuable technique in a training program. If you're doing multiple day training and people can go out and come back, to show the pictures of the actual sites.
And actually justifies using PowerPoint. Which many trainings don't. Other questions or comments?
I have a quick question for you about the logistics of the training that you held. Like, were you out there at 6 a.m. or just also, how many people came?
What's that? How many
people? Well, how many people actually, I'm curious about the 1 hour session. Is it come and go, you're called for a job, or how many were
there? There's some of that. They were out at, they were there like at 6:30 for a 7 to 8 a.m. session. Some people would have gone out already by then, but others not. There was some coming and going if somebody got called. One of the centers, I think Hillary actually had an arrangement with the dispatcher that if the person was in the class that he would like save the job for him so he didn't have to disrupt it. But you know, there was chaos. One of the venues was the TV room, and so it actually sounded like it was one of these dynamics where finally after the third or fourth week, enough people were interested in the training that they got the other people to turn the TV off, but it didn't always happen. And so, yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, if you've done training on construction sites, it kind of has that feel to it. But yeah, they were out. It was a real commitment. They were out every Monday morning early for many weeks.
Did you get any feel for what percentage of people using the sites went to at least one of your trainings?
Yeah, because it only comes on as a full screen. It doesn't let you get out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not really PowerPoint anymore. It's something else.
Yeah, it's a